Sunday.
It does feel like a Sunday.
It feels like a Sunday.
It does feel like a Sunday. I agree.
Yeah. Even though it's Monday.
Yeah.
And it's not a holiday thing because I don't work Mondays anyway. So. Yeah.
Mm. I think it's because, like, there's no traffic.
Yeah, it could be that.
And it's very Sunday vibes in Portland today. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the holiday.
Yeah.
So, and it's not middle of the week, so you didn't have to work 3 days and then get off and then work 2 more days.
Yeah.
You know? So.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's all. That all matches. What are you doing?
I keep trying to move this, and then this just goes,
ooh. Ooh, do you have floppy sock dick phone?
Oh, you got flaccid mic.
Yeah. Maybe that's part of the reason.
You have floppy dick phone.
Not sounding correct, because this keeps moving.
Erectile mic dysfunction.
Yeah, because, you sound weird now to me. Because you have floppy dick phone.
See?
There you are. Well, I mean, you were fine before. Like I said, you didn't sound tinny to me.
It just kept moving, like, a little, like, incrementally, teeny tiny.
Incrementally.
Until it just totally...
Floppy dick phone. I've had floppy dick phone before. I don't know what's happening.
That was a weird sound. It sounded like something out of an old-timey horror movie.
Yeah,
like the door of a haunted house.
That was kind of cool.
Maybe I need to cut that for folly.
Keep that clip just in case.
Shit. Wow. I got doors that I use in the other show.
Yeah, I mean.
I'm also leaving that in. Everybody gets to hear that.
Oh, yeah, leave it. It was great.
Yeah.
Definitely, I mean, yeah. Sure. Well, it's not boring at all.
Yeah, no.
Sometimes we're going to have fucking boring ones.
Unlike the door of a haunted house.
Yeah.
Never boring.
Definitely
but hey,
not.
Welcome to Ghosts and Hoes.
Ghosts and Hoes.
Burp-a-der.
Yeah, Ghosts and Hoes, a paranormal podcast where we talk about all things spoopy, cryptids, aliens, motherfucking witchcraft.
Sometimes.
Murder most motherfucking foul.
Especially recently.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And it's going to get real bad.
The past, like, 4 months, y'all can't stop talking about dead people.
Hey, I brought on some witchiness. I brought on, I brought on some witch trials.
I don't remember what I've been doing, so I can't
help you. Yeah.
I don't know. I barely know where I am right now.
Well.
Girl, same. I'm in my home.
Yeah. There's that.
That mad dash to the airport was was a lot. I was not expecting that.
Yeah.
Nobody loves a trip to the airport to, like...
Unexpectedly.
To do the drop-off and pick-up thing, but especially when you're not expecting.
Well,
it. Surprise.
Like, 11:45, she's like, hey, so I need to go because of some shit. My mom was visiting. I was like, okay. She goes, what is changing flights look like? I'm like, well, I can get you out at 1:30 in an hour and 45 minutes or 7:55 p.m. tonight, which is going to cost a lot more money.
Yeah.
She was like, I guess we're leaving now.
Right now. Which is odd, the price difference.
Yeah.
So much different, well, like, in an hour as opposed to a few.
Right.
That feels weird.
This one had stuff. She's got to go to Seattle.
Oh.
And then down to Orange County.
Well.
Whatever. The deed is done, and she hasn't, her plane leaves in half an hour, and I have not heard about her missing anything.
That's good.
I'm hoping.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah. She texts me in 20 minutes, like, I just got through TSA. I'm like, all right, well, fuck. Cool.
Shark farts to that.
Boring business. Sorry, everybody.
Yeah. Hey, right. Do we have backhoes?
Of course. We always do.
We're getting a late start, boo. We got to move it along.
Let's move. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, don't be. Shit happens.
First, the Lady of the Dunes killer has been named.
Oh.
Yes. If you'll remember, Danielle covered that a while ago.
Oh.
She was a cold case up until very recently. Very brutal murder. And according to a CBS article, the killer, her case has officially been closed. And investigators say that her husband, Guy Moldovan, killed her in 1974.
Ah.
Yep.
Who were the main suspects when you covered?
There weren't a ton.
Uh-uh.
Okay.
There weren't really a ton because they didn't. Because her hands were missing. Gone. So they couldn't print her. They didn't know who she was.
They didn't know who she was until enough to know.
There was no, until very recently, she was identified.
DNA?
Yeah. But he died in 2002.
Oh, okay. So.
But it has now been solved and officially closed. So not only did she get her name back, her case has been solved.
Wow.
So that is lovely.
Very, very cool.
Yeah. Yes, indeed.
And I also promised to find more details on the Ed Gein trick-or-treating thing.
Oh.
And I had to track down that episode of My Favorite Murder, which happened a while ago. It was from 2017. But I found it. So here I will clarify, if anybody wants to listen to the whole episode, it's fucking hilarious, so you should. It's episode 181, live at the Riverside Theater in Milwaukee. So a woman named Sarah got up to share her hometown, and it was a story that she was reading from her father, Steve, who was a psychologist. So when Steve was in college, she pointed out it was 1982, the year of the Tylenol poisoning, so trick-or-treating was already not really a thing happening in that area at the time because, you know, people were poisoning strangers for fun. But her dad was a volunteer who worked with kids at Mendota Mental Health. And at Halloween, the nurses brought in costumes for the kids and took them trick-or-treating at other units where nurses and other patients would hand out candy and treats to the kids. So it wasn't just random neighborhood kids going trick-or-treating at the mental health facility. They were actually patients. The children were patients at this facility. And so there were some units where the patients were considered too dangerous for the children to directly get candy from them. So they would pass the candy through a security slot instead of handing it directly to them. But when they went to the gerontology unit, a.k.a. where the elderly folks were kept, the patients were handing out Reese's cups. And while they were waiting for all of the elderly patients from that unit to get in line to hand out candy, or everybody that wanted to, one of the nurses turned around and asked a patient, Eddie, do you want to give the kids some candy? And it was Ed Gein. So he was in the gerontology unit. And this girl's dad was a volunteer. He turned around and looked, and it was Ed Gein. Ed Gein, no, he did not want to hand out candy. So the man, her dad, acknowledged him and was like, hi. And then Ed asked him if they were going to be leaving soon. And he was like, yep, we sure are.
Are you going to be leaving soon? Can you go now?
I don't love seeing. So there were no worries because Eddie had no desire to be remotely near children in any way, shape, or form.
Fair enough.
So to clarify, that was what happened. And then RIP Jimmy Buffett.
Yes.
Jimmy Buffett.
Big Margaritaville in the sky.
Big Margaritaville in the sky.
Yep. All right.
That's it. That's all I got.
Let's dig.
All right. Who goes first?
You do.
Oh, boy.
Yes.
Okay.
Oh. Yes, you do.
Yeah. 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 Let me put on my eye barts.
Confused me for a second because we were here yesterday. And I was like, wait.
Oh, yeah.
That's right. We janged the fuck out of yesterday.
Jangy, jang, jang. Ding, dang, jang. All right.
7 feet as the face flies.
So, if you didn't listen last week, you're fucked. You have to go back because we're both doing part twos.
Yeah, if you are, this is the episode you started with, go back because you're going to be real confused.
Yeah. Yeah.
Real confused if you don't.
Welcome back to Krista Pike, part deux. The horrors.
The horrors.
So when we left off last week, Krista and her parents had just toured the Job Corps dorms at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville in the fall of 1994. And for those that are not familiar with Job Corps, it's a no-cost education and vocational training program administered by the U.S. Department of Labor that helps at-risk youth and young adults ages 16 to 24 to improve the quality of their lives by empowering them to get great jobs and become independent.
Yes.
So, well, Not long after starting at Ye Olde Job Corps, Krista met 17-year-old Tadaryl Shipp and 18-year-old Shadola Peterson. Krista and Shadola hit it off pretty quick and apparently had a lot in common, including a shared interest in Satanism, which they both claimed to have practiced.
Okay.
So Tadaryl was also apparently into the occult, and the three of them were overheard frequently talking about participating in a human sacrifice, which no one took seriously. Krista had at this point now started calling herself Lil Devil.
Oh, okay.
Lil, L-I, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm.
And Tadaryl had a shrine to Satan in his dorm room. Naturally, a romantic relationship between the two formed fairly quickly, and Tadaryl had also had a rough childhood. He had been raised by a single mom who struggled to make ends meet. They were very poor, lived in a bad neighborhood, and Tadaryl would run with several street gangs until eventually becoming a member of the Gangster Disciples, as would Shadola Peterson be a member, by the way. Anywho, Shipp got himself involved in many a criminal activity and dropped out of school in the ninth grade, so he, like Krista, was trying to make one last-ditch effort to get his life together, and he joined the Job Corps to study culinary arts. Unfortunately, the pair spent most of their time getting into trouble together instead of studying. Krista went back home to her parents' house for Christmas break, and she told her mom that a girl that she had met at Job Corps had been threatening her, and that this girl would be hovering over her bed at night with a knife or something, threatening her.
No, thank you.
But Krista also told her mom not to worry because her friend Tadaryl would protect her. And she had also brought some crystals home. Crystals, words are fucking hard. She brought some crystals home with her, telling her mom that Tadaryl used those same crystals to make the clouds move and make the sky open up.
Okay.
Now, the girl that Krista had been referring to as that was harassing her was 19-year-old Colleen Slemmer. Except, I don't think that's quite how it was going down.
Uh-oh.
But before I get there, let's talk about the Job Corps campus itself. Andrew Drace arrived at the Knoxville Center in October 1994, and he had also been at Swannanoa with Krista.
Oh, okay.
And he would later say in his testimony that while Swannanoa was small and that everybody knew everybody, the Job Corps program was a pretty rough, violent place. He stated that there were gangs that picked on people and that they would go into students' rooms, put sheets over them, and beat them because they were white. There were less than 10 white male students at the center.
Huh.
And Drace would later testify that Tadaryl Shipp was one of those gang members and that he was in fear of him on a daily basis. He also stated that on one occasion, Tadaryl had attempted to throw him from a bridge near the center and that out of fear for their own safety, a lot of students just stayed in their rooms. He also added that the Job Corps group from Knoxville had the stigma of being evil, terrible people.
Oh.
William Joseph Mode was an instructor at the Job Corps program in 1994, and he taught cultural awareness, reading, and AODA, which is a class on drugs and alcohol, and parenting. Mr. Mode would later testify that he had been under the impression, accepting the position at the campus, that the Job Corps students did not have violent criminal backgrounds. Changed his mind pretty quickly. He described incidents of being slapped and hit by students, as well as one particular incident where a student had threatened to kill him.
Oh, goodness.
He also testified that Tadaryl Shipp often came to class high, hungover, or drunk, if he came at all.
Oh, goodness.
He described Tadaryl as disrespectful, and he stated that there was little discipline by the Job Corps supervisors. He also said that he had heard from several students that the dorms were unsafe. Now let's get to Colleen Slemmer. So Colleen was from Jacksonville, Florida, and like everyone else, she was at Job Corps to turn her life around, and she was going to study computer technology. She ran in a completely different circle than Krista, and in fact, they probably never would have crossed paths if it wasn't for a rumor that had started to go around involving Colleen and Tadaryl.
Oh.
There had been some sort of chatter about Colleen pursuing Tadaryl, and they had actually and that they had actually hooked up at some point. Now, it's unclear whether there was ever any validity to the rumor. Colleen denied it repeatedly, as did her friends, but to Daryl would later eventually confess that they had hooked up behind Krista's back.
Oh, no.
To Daryl would later testify that he and Krista dated, but that she took the relationship way more serious than he had, and that he had 100% been seeing many other girls at the same time, but that he didn't think that Krista had known. Either way, Krista was incredibly jealous and possessive of her boyfriend, and she wasn't going to let another girl have him, whether that relationship was real or imagined. So Krista confronted to Daryl, and he at the time, of course, denied having any interest in Colleen, but the little devil wasn't having it, and she said that she needed proof that she was the only one for him. So naturally, they came up with a plan to kill Colleen.
Oh, boy.
And Krista convinced Daryl and Shadola that Colleen needed to be sacrificed in the name of Satan.
Oh, bless it.
Classmates would later tell police that Krista would walk around and talk all kinds of shit about how much she hated Colleen and that she wanted to kill her. However, no one thought she was serious, except for Shadola, who knew full well what her plan was.
Yeah, she's like, oh, guys, please...
Yeah.
Please take this seriously.
And
she means it.
Yeah. And Colleen had no idea the extent of the hatred that Krista had for her. So Tadaryl stayed friends with Colleen, talking to her every day in order to gain her trust so that the three of them could put their plan into motion. And on January 11th, 1995, Krista told her friend Kim Lolio that she planned to kill Colleen Slemmer just because... she felt mean that day.
Oh,
Lolio just dismissed it as part of her weird Satan bullshit talk that she always did. But that dismissal would later turn to regret.
I'll bet. Oh, that's upsetting.
On the evening of January 12th, 1995, Krista put the plan into motion, and under the guise of squashing her beef with Colleen, she asked her if she'd like to hang out with her and Shadola and to Daryl, and that they were going to walk to the old Blockbuster, and that she had some weed hidden in the park that they would stop and smoke on the way, make peace, then grab a movie. Colleen unfortunately agreed, and at around 8 p.m., the four were seen walking away together from the Job Corps dorm. However, only three would return a few hours later. The trigger warning... I probably should have mentioned before now, but I think y'all knew. I gave lots of warnings on how bad this was going to be.
Said it last week, but it starts now.
It starts here now.
For today.
And I'm telling you, it's really, 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 really bad. So, buckle up. So, Colleen had been led to a very remote area on the University of Tennessee Agricultural Campus, supposedly on the way to where the weed was hidden. The location was chosen because it was so isolated that no one would have been able to hear Colleen scream.
Hmm.
Once they were there, Krista's personality and demeanor changed instantly. She turned to Colleen and immediately started making the same accusations about her wanting to steal to Daryl from her. Shadola acted as a lookout to make sure that no one came that way, and for the next hour... Colleen was taunted, beaten, and viciously tortured. First, Colleen was forced to take off her shirt and bra because they, and I'm not sure whose idea it was, thought that that would keep her from running away.
Oh.
Then Krista, as she would later confess, began hitting Colleen and bashing her head against her knee. She then threw her to the ground and kicked her repeatedly. Then as she grabbed her head to slam it against the concrete, Colleen asked repeatedly, "Why are you doing this to me?" According to Krista's statement, Colleen said that she was going to tell at first, and she threatened to report her and get her kicked out of Job Corps. So she again repeatedly kicked Colleen in the face and sighed, later saying that she laid on the ground for a while crying, then tried to run away. But Tadaryl caught her and pushed her to the ground and held her there until she stopped struggling. He then dragged her a little further out, which was when Krista pulled out a box cutter.
No.
And she slashed it across Colleen's back, stomach, breasts, and at the crotch of her jeans. According to Krista, Colleen screamed and screamed. She then recounted how she began to hear voices in her head telling her that she had to do something to prevent Colleen from telling on her and sending her to prison for attempted murder. Krista then pulled out a meat cleaver, slashed Colleen some more.
Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm. And then she would later say that she just stood over Colleen and just watching her bleed. Oof. Colleen, however, fighting for her life, rolled over, stood up, and tried to run away again. But Krista cut her by giving her what she called the big long cut on her back. During her confession, she said that Colleen had repeatedly tried to get up and run. Krista also recounted how she had tried to bargain for her life, begging Krista to just talk to her, and said that if they would just let her go, she'll go back to Florida and not even go back to the dorm to get her belongings. To which Krista replied, "Shut up. I don't want to hear you talking to me. You know it's harder to hurt somebody when they're talking to you."
Jesus.
She would later say that the more Colleen talked, the more she kicked her in the face. Krista then handed the box cutter to Daryl, and he carved a pentagram into Colleen's chest to prove to Krista that Colleen was indeed going to be a human sacrifice to Satan.
Oh, good God.
Krista then thought that she heard a noise, so she went to check it out. When she got back, she slashed Colleen's throat. Yet after 45 minutes of brutal fucking torture, she was still alive. She continued to beg for her life, and each time, Krista slashed her throat again. Somehow, in a last-ditch attempt to escape, Colleen stood up, bleeding out, and tried to make a run for it. She was pushed back down again by Tadaryl, and that's when Krista picked up a chunk of asphalt and began to beat Colleen in the head with it. At her trial, she would later say that she could hear Slemmer breathing blood in and out, and she could see her jerking, but that she just kept hitting her and hitting her and hitting her. And she said, "Colleen, do you know who's doing this to you?" To which the only response at that point was groaning noises. Colleen's head had been hit so much that her face was not even recognizable. Pieces of her skull were sticking out of her head. And Krista tore out a piece, stuck it in her jacket pocket to keep as a souvenir, or, according to some sources, to follow a satanic belief that ensured that Colleen's soul would remain trapped and never find peace inside a broken body.
For fuck's sake.
So, Krista and Tadaryl then each grabbed one of Colleen's feet, drug her to an area near some trees, left her body on a pile of dirt and leaves. They put her shirt and bra in the bushes, and they washed blood off their hands in a mud puddle. They threw Colleen's ID away at a gas station, then all three headed back to the dorms like nothing had fucking happened.
Good God.
So Krista got back to her room around 11 p.m. that night. Her roommate was there. And Krista in no fucking way tried to hide anything. In fact, she straight up told her roommate that she just killed Colleen. And when the roommate didn't believe her, she pulled the piece of skull out of her pocket to prove it. Later on, this roommate would testify in court that Krista appeared to be very proud of what she had done. She was smiling and dancing around as she retold the story. And the next morning, she'd also bragged to other students that she had part of human bone in her possession and was just showing it off to anyone that would look at it. And another classmate had commented about all the mud on her shoes, but Krista said, "That ain't mud, that's blood. Human blood."
Mm-hmm.
So, now, no one reported Krista's claims to the police because I'm assuming they didn't believe her. But thankfully, it did not take long for Colleen Slemmer's body to be found. In the early morning hours of January 13th, the campus employee stumbled upon what he believed to be the remains of an animal. But when he looked closer, he realized that it was a mangled human body, so badly beaten that when the police were called, the first responding officer couldn't tell if he was looking at a face or not.
Oh.
The scene was secured by law enforcement, and word started to get around that there was a crime scene nearby, so naturally a large crowd formed around the scene, and Krista heard about it and immediately went and asked the police if they had any suspects, and she seemed strangely excited and happy when talking to them.
I hate it. I hate everything so much.
Now, Krista bragged about the killing to just about anyone who would listen to her, so once Colleen's body was found, it didn't take long for the police to figure out who their main suspect was. And when investigators checked the logbook of the school, where students have to sign in and out whenever they leave, it showed that Colleen, Krista, Tadaryl, and Shadola all signed out around the same time, but that Colleen never signed back in. Guys, pretty simple to figure out who did this.
Yeah.
So needless to say, the trio were immediately arrested and taken in for questioning, where they all gave the police permission to search their dorm rooms. And in Krista's, they found her jeans soaked with blood, as well as the murder weapons. And she was really fucked after the police got a call from a Job Corps counselor who had found a jacket that Krista had left in his office that day, and in the pocket was a piece of what looked like a human skull. So, Krista confessed. A 42-page confession, by the way.
Oh.
Where she also gave up to Daryl and Shadola pretty quickly and was seemingly very proud of what she'd done and showed absolutely no fucking remorse. She even got up at one point and physically reenacted what she had done for the police.
Boy, I hate it.
Mm-hmm. She admitted that the women had beef, and she tried to blame Colleen for trying to steal her man, and that it was just a fight that had gone too far, saying, "I don't want to say that I intended to kill her, but I would say that I didn't care if she died. I wouldn't lose any sleep over it if she did."
Huh. Mm-hmm. This lady sucks.
Uh-huh.
Like, didn't you also say beforehand that you wanted to kill her, though?
Mm-hmm. To anyone who would listen? Yeah.
So, okay.
Yeah. Yep. She also admitted that the killing had lasted over 30 minutes and that she was frustrated by the fact that Colleen would not die quick enough.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Krista showed investigators where she had dumped the evidence, including Colleen's ID, and then she retraced her steps back to the scene of the crime, giving them all the details they needed, including everything that Tadaryl and Shadola had done. Krista Pike was charged with murder. Good. Colleen's official cause of death was blunt force trauma to the head. And according to the Knox County Medical Examiner, Dr. Sandra Elkins, 19-year-old Colleen Slemmer had to be identified by dental records. Dr. Elkins had attempted to catalog the slash and stab wounds on Colleen's torso by assigning, you know, there's A, B, mm-hmm. C. Yeah. Well, she had to stop, because there were so many wounds that eventually she would only catalog the most serious and major wounds, because there were over 300.
Christ. Wow.
Why? She literally said in court that she started and then eventually she just threw up her hands. It was like, fuck it. She didn't say that, but I'm paraphrasing.
She probably felt
it. In that moment, yeah. She said,
I mean, hey, she very well may have.
She said, if I cataloged these alphabetically, I would have had to repeatedly go over the alphabet and I probably would have been in the morgue for 3 days.
Yeah. Not enough letters.
Not enough. Alphabet. Not enough. Not enough.
Really hate that.
Yeah. There were over 300. Colleen's mom said it looked to her to be over 500.
Good Lord.
Right. So, it's really bad. Mm-hmm. Krista Pike's murder trial began on March 22nd, 1996. The prosecutors had her confession, and Dr. Elkins testified on the stand that she had to completely remove the skull from the body in order to have it pieced back together.
Wow.
Hoy-yay.
That's crazy.
Yep. And that several segments of her skull had been lodged into the brain. Dr. Elkins presented the piece of skull that Krista had taken as well. And as we all know, it was an exact match to the missing section of the reconstructed skull. It was a perfect fit. So the defense had two experts, Dr. Eric Engham, a clinical psychologist, and Dr. Jonathan Pincus, a neurologist. According to Dr. Engham, the tests he had done on Krista showed that she had no symptoms of brain damage and that she was not insane. He concluded, though, that she had bipolar disorder as well as a very severe case of borderline personality disorder. Dr. Jonathan Pincus studied Krista's brain and found that her frontal lobes were not put together properly, and it's the frontal lobe where our sense of right and wrong is developed and recorded. He testified that he believed that He believed that when Carissa was pregnant, the heavy drinking resulted in Krista's brain not forming properly.
Okay.
He continued to say that every killer he has ever examined shares three features: brain damage, a history of abuse, and mental illness, which Krista had all three. But so have many a serial killer. These factors are possibly a reason for her committing murder, but they are absolutely not an excuse for committing murder. Krista would smile and wave during her trial, showing absolutely no remorse. But when her 45-minute taped confession was played to the jury, well, that was the only time she cried. And due to Krista's lack of remorse, it only took the jury a couple hours of deliberation to find her guilty of first-degree murder and of conspiracy to commit murder. Then on March 30th, 1996, Krista Pike was sentenced to death by electrocution. As for Tadarrell Shipp, he would be convicted of murder and sentenced to life plus 25. Shadola Peterson, however, took a plea deal, testifying against both Krista and Tadarrell. She served 460 days in jail and was given 6 years of probation for accessory after the fact. So Krista was sent to death row. The first thing she did was write a letter to her man, Tadarrell.
Oh, of course.
It was never delivered to him. It was instead intercepted and sent to the Knox County District Attorney General because they knew that the appeals would be coming. And this letter was later read aloud at a subsequent hearing for Krista and her appeals. And if anyone ever had any doubt as to whether or not Krista had remorse or if this was, you know, not knowing right and wrong for an underdeveloped brain, you know, borderline personality, not able to control emotions. Well, let me just clear that up real quick for you. The letter read, "Please write me. I miss you so much. You see what I get for trying to be nice to the hoe? I went ahead and bashed her brains out so she'd die quickly instead of letting her bleed to death and suffer more, and they fucking fry me. Ain't that some shit? Please write me and tell me how you're feeling. Also, tell your lawyer if he wants me to testify for you. I will. Love you for the rest of my life. Lil Devil."
Oh, that just makes me want to... I can't even...
Yep. Then in 2004, Krista got into a tiff with another inmate named Patricia Jones, and she tried to strangle her to death with a shoestring. Again.
Great.
Krista has absolutely no remorse or even tries to hide her crimes. She was talking to her mother about the whole damn thing on the phone from prison. "Those phones are all recorded, Krista."
Yeah.
She said, "I wrapped that shoestring around her and tried to choke the life out of her. She was passed out on the ground, Mama, twitching, foaming at the mouth. Her eyeballs was bugged out so far. Her eyelids were flipped up. If I'd had 30 more seconds, we'd have a little chalk line out there in our rec pen, and that bitch would be gone somewhere."
Fuck's sake.
Right. Well, she was charged again with first-degree attempted murder. Not that it really matters, because she's already on death row. But still, she was charged with it. Rightfully so. Then again, in March 2012, Krista tried to escape prison by bribing a corrections officer and conspiring with another inmate. The plan failed because they had knew what was about to happen. And the corrections officer was fired, clearly.
Good.
So on the 27th of August, 2020, the state of Tennessee petitioned the court to finally set a date of execution for Krista Pike. She had exhausted all of her appeals, and she's the only woman currently on death row in the state of Tennessee. Colleen Slemmer's mother, Mae Martinez, also wants the state to make a decision, saying, "Honestly, my heart breaks every single day because I keep reliving it and reliving it. Execute her or give her her life and give me the rest of Colleen back so I can live." What she's referring to is her daughter's skull, which was eventually returned to her, but Mae continues to wait on the state of Tennessee to they won't release the skull fragment.
Oh, that's so fucked.
That they keep locked in evidence, saying, "Over the years, Tennessee has mailed me body parts in a box, not saying what it is or anything like that. I just get body parts." And Mae refuses to bury her child until all of her remains are finally together. Unfortunately, that skull fragment is still considered crucial evidence, and the state of Tennessee will not release it until Colleen's murderer is executed.
Then fucking do why? It.
So until then, the rest of Colleen's body waits for that day to come, sitting cremated in a pewter box in her mother's home.
Christ almighty.
As of August 30th, 2023.
Just the other day.
Just the other fucking day. Krista's attorneys are asking the court to reconsider her death sentence in lieu of a new Tennessee Supreme Court ruling that juveniles are constitutionally different than adults when it comes to sentencing them for crimes. So I guess we will see what happens and if and when they do decide to put her to death. Krista Pike would be the first woman to be executed in the state of Tennessee in roughly 200 years.
Good God.
That is the very sad and tragic fucking story of Krista Pike, the youngest woman to be sentenced to death in the horrifying murder of Colleen Slemmer.
Jesus.
Look, Tennessee.
Get your shit together.
Like, she's on death row. What does it matter? So it's going to matter somehow. She's already been convicted. This is not going to be overturned. No. She admitted to doing it.
Yes, she did.
Give Mae that piece of skull. Why does it need to be held for evidence?
You don't.
You have a full confession.
You already got all the evidence out of it that you're going to. Because, again, she fucking confessed.
Yeah.
And everybody knows. And I've heard about that law before. The children not being able to be sentenced to life in prison, blah, blah, all that stuff. But
she was 18.
She was 18. So she was legally, in the eyes of the courts, an adult. And also, if you're gonna, then just commute it to a life sentence.
Yeah, and but do something.
Return it.
That's what she's saying.
The skull. Exactly. Yeah. That's like, what is...
Kill her. Or give her her life, but give me my daughter's skull fragment back.
Yeah, like what? Why?
Because she refuses to bury her child without. And I do not blame her.
No, I'm just saying Tennessee. Yeah, why the fuck?
Yeah,
why?
What the fuck?
What is the point of that?
Like, yeah,
what? You're just continually re-victimizing this poor woman whose daughter was horrifically, brutally murdered. That's on you.
Yeah.
Obviously she would never get over that, but that would at least give her a tiny semblance of some kind of closure.
Yeah. And so another reason, aside from length, that I did this in two parts is because, like I said, the sources out there mainly cover just the trial and barely the trial, mainly the murder, but there wasn't a lot about Krista herself.
Yeah.
Which is why I went through transcripts of the confession and her court and the trial. And it's interesting because some of you may have at the end of last week really felt bad for Krista. Her childhood, her upbringing, the abuses, it was terrible.
Mm-hmm.
It was terrible. But it's kind of like I said, you know, are monsters born or are monsters made? Either way, she's a fucking monster.
I think it depends on the monster.
I don't think that this has anything to do with her bipolar, her personality disorder. So the psychologist, it was for the defense, and he was like, well, her borderline personality is so severe that she is incapable of controlling her emotions. So this wasn't a murder out of malice. She just wasn't able to control her emotions, and this is what she did. No. Mm-mm. Nice try. Nice try. But yeah, no.
I don't agree Absolutely
not.
I don't agree with your assessment.
Absolutely not. Because Doctor, she kept saying that, I'm going to kill her. I fucking hate her. I'm going to kill her.
Yeah.
You know? She meant it.
Yeah.
She meant it.
She did.
You know, and then that letter she wrote...
Ugh.
Girl, no. Absolutely not.
No.
Absolutely not.
No.
Absolutely not. Yeah. You know, and like I said, her Aunt Carrie led a very productive life. NICU nurse. Her sister Alicia and moved to Texas, has her kids, her husband, a business, is thriving, like... not that they didn't all have shitty childhoods. They did.
Yeah.
They did.
There are plenty of people that have had shitty childhoods that never viciously murder anybody.
And clearly there's something wrong with Krista. I mean, that's just...
Yes.
I get it. Sure. Fine. Bipolar. Yeah, personality documented. Disorder. She clearly has a personality disorder, but still. They don't run around and kill people. That's not how that works.
There are... millions of people with the same
exact
problems, issues, health concerns
that
have never brutally murdered anybody.
But, you know, the psychologist did say, you know, she's not insane. She's not. So all that tells me is she's a fucking vile, horrible fucking monster that murdered a girl and didn't care. Didn't care. But see, now her whole thing is she's trying to say that she's better now, she's an adult now, and she shouldn't be held responsible for the horrible choices she made as a teenager. That's been the whole shtick of their appeals, which of all, she's exhausted them all. But see, now that's why her lawyers are trying to glom onto this.
Yeah.
Okay, but still, she was 18. Yeah, that is a child. Technically,
legally an adult.
Right. But not really. You're still a child. And I do agree with that, but I don't care. You still, that's a right and wrong. 18-year-olds know right from wrong. Do they still do stupid shit? Yeah.
Well, that's because you're 18. Everybody does. But
this is beyond stupid shit.
That's not stupid shit.
This was brutally beating a girl to death.
Calculated.
And relishing in it.
Calculated. Violent. Mm-hmm. Horrific. Mm-hmm. Behavior.
And it was all her.
That's not 18-year-old behavior.
It was all her. The only thing to Daryl did was any time Colleen tried to get up and run, he'd put her back down, and the only thing he did was carve the pentagram into her chest. And he did do it. He admitted to it.
Yeah, which is still plenty.
But Krista did the rest. That was all her.
Yeah.
All of it. So, my sources... a wiki, which really didn't have a lot. Because like I said, this one, for being such a big story, there's not like a lot out there.
It happens.
Originalnewsbreak.com, Nick. Medium, The Mystique, Nick Young, Miss Spooks, all separate articles. Casetext.com, Wickedness.net, Unquestionably Criminal, Rivy Lion, and WBIR.com, John North and Vinay Simlot.
Lovely.
Yeah. The majority of what I got was from CaseNet. That's the transcripts.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
I think I have used either that website or a similar one in the past.
Yes.
Well, it's my turn. That's my turn.
I really need to go take some ibuprofen, so I'll be right back.
Do that. Words cannot express how much I didn't want to keep writing about this case. But I'm not gonna leave y'all hanging. Just know that the temptation... ooh, Skronk. Temptation to just not. Just leave it at what I did and find another Jeff the Talking Mongoose.
Right? Well, and you know what's interesting with both of our stories? We're like, yeah, okay, this is a good case. Yeah. And it's one of those where it wasn't simple.
I knew as soon as I sat down. Actually, because like I said, it had been on my list for a while, mm-hmm. and this is why. Because I knew.
And I knew mine was going to be bad. I just didn't know, like, how the research-wise. Yeah. It's like I'm deciphering.
Yeah.
And it just, it...
Mine...
It wasn't going to be short.
No.
And I was just like, oh,
that's,
shit.
That's why. And I'll kind of explain it later, because there are a lot of pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, well, shit. Because Marliza's case is generally an afterthought.
Mm-hmm.
In something else. Yeah. So. But, you know, I just, like I said, I was hoping just to, maybe people would forget that I said there was more. And be like, nope, I never said that, and just gaslight you all into thinking that it was just that. And that was the end. But I was like, I can't do that to you. Lord, I wish. Because it's about to get so much worse. And I just hate it so much. So to put off the horrors for as long as I can, which unfortunately won't be long enough at all, let's just do a quick recap. Jody and Hannah Foster moved into an apartment in Chico on January 31st, 2000. Shit's haunted. Jody's daughter has a not-so-imaginary friend, as it would turn out, that she called My Liz. Jody has horrific dreams of a couple who seem to have kidnapped, tortured, and killed a young woman. They move out of the apartment after 3 months. A year later, Jody's dreams return. Her boyfriend finds a book about a different case, which briefly mentions the disappearance of a young woman named Marie Elizabeth Sponicky. Turns out, I said it wrong.
Uh-huh.
I guess a lot of people have been saying it wrong, according to Marliza's sister, Sponicky, not Spanicky. So, yes, Marliz. My Liz. So, that's your very brief overview. And I feel like we're all about to take a ride on Willy Wonka's Nightmare Boat. This is okay. On to the horrors we go. Who exactly was Marliz Sponicky? Marie Elizabeth was born in Cleveland, Ohio on June 20th, 1956, to parents Ernest or Ernst, depending on your source, and Dorothea Sponicky. She was one of seven kids, but unfortunately, there's not a ton of information out there about Marliz's life, which really bums me out. But from the limited information I could find, she seemed absolutely lovely. By all accounts, she was, quote, outgoing, friendly, and beautiful, end quote. She was about 5'5", with long brown hair, and despite some reports claiming she had green eyes, her older sister Martha said that Marliz's eyes were as blue as the sky.
Aww.
From what I could find, she seemed to be more into creative endeavors like sculpting and music. She also became interested in acting and dreamt of moving to California to become a famous actress. Whomst among us? She graduated high school, started working, and in 1975, Marliz met a handsome young co-worker named John Baruth. Despite their six-year age difference, the pair hit it off almost immediately, much to the annoyance of her parents. Especially her mother, who believed John was a quote-unquote hoodlum.
Oh no.
Baruth, who was originally from California, planned on returning home to attend Chico State and asked Marliz to join him. Between her dreams of stardom and love for her hunky boyfriend, the choice was an easy and immediate yes. The pair moved to Chico shortly after that and found a little apartment on Parmack Road. Sources vary a bit on what happened next, but it seems that Marliz started working as a store clerk and doing some part-time modeling for a camera shop. Hmm. And some say she was just modeling for the camera shop while she was looking for more full-time work. But she was doing all of this while John went to Butte College. She told friends that things between her and John were great and that they'd actually even gotten engaged. Oh, God. But the honeymoon phase seemed to end pretty fast.
Ruh-roh.
And after a couple of months in Chico, Marliz wanted to go home. Her sister Martha would later share on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries that she suspected there was trouble in paradise after Marliz had told her in a letter that she'd planned on returning to Ohio and attending college in April. She suspected that her sister was lonely and homesick. She didn't have any family or friends in California, just John. And that Chico also wasn't what she'd expected. I mean, For being an 18 to 19-year-old young woman who dreamt of becoming a movie star, Chico certainly wouldn't have been my first choice of places in California to move.
No.
Lovely. But yes, no. But not for that purpose. No. So I could very much see getting there and being super disappointed, being like, this isn't.
This ain't it.
Chico is not Hollywood. Which, no.
No.
Very much not. Other sources claim that Marliz had actually planned on flying home as early as February 1st, because Dorothea had allegedly bought a one-way ticket for her to go back to Cleveland, but the ticket was never picked up. On January 31st, 1976, Marliz and John hit up a flea market at East 20th and Mulberry Street. Some say that they were working a booth there, but I wasn't able to verify that information. In any event, the couple started arguing, and after a while, Marliz had it. She decided to walk the 4 miles back to their apartment instead of driving back with John. He would later say that he watched her walk down Mangrove Avenue at roughly 4 p.m., which was sadly the last time anyone that loved her would ever see her alive. So, John got back to their apartment, but there were no signs of Marliz. He waited for her to come back, but after 48 hours of neither hide nor hair of her, he called the police to report her missing. I'm assuming he was just waiting for her to maybe cool off.
Yeah.
Whatever, but no. As is often the case, the police initially suspected that John may have had something to do with her disappearance, especially after talking to friends who said that Marliz had, quote-unquote, grown tired of their relationship. After speaking with Dorothea, her mother, who also claimed that John had been involved in the California drug culture.
Oh, no.
It felt very...
weed.
Yeah. What was that? Help.
What?
The anti-weed movie from the...
Reefer Madness.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It seemed like a very Reefer Madness kind of take from her. But he was like, I don't... No. No. I mean, not anymore, but no. Yeah. And even, I feel like the involvement would have been like, hey, I bought a bag of stems.
Right?
Because it's 1976.
Yeah.
But after speaking with all, he was questioned extensively. He told them that even if she had wanted to end their relationship, he would never and had never hurt her.
Right.
He also said that all of her stuff, including her luggage and toothbrush, had been exactly as she'd left it on January 31st. So it's not like she'd beat him home from the flea market, packed up all her shit, and bounced before he could get home and try and stop her. Uh-huh. Like, she was just not there. And even if that had been the case, she had gone home, taken some of her stuff, and left, she would have already been back in Cleveland by then if her mom had... reserved a ticket for her at the airport.
Right.
She would have been gone. She would have just been home.
Right.
However, we all know he wasn't involved. But the 5-0 had to check anyway, because they didn't have 40-some-odd years of information like we do. Uh-huh. Any hopes. On one occasion, a detective was at the apartment to interview John when the phone rang. John answered, but whomstever was on the other end of the line hung up before saying anything. Weird. But not super unusual, except for the fact that John said it had happened frequently after Marliz had disappeared.
Oh, interesting.
Just random hang-up calls. John then agreed to a polygraph, which he passed, and shortly after that, he was cleared as a suspect. Which, we all know.
Yes, we all know.
But it was the 70s, and they were still thought to be scientifically ahead of the game.
We all know he was telling the truth.
Yes, we do.
So.
Yes, we do. My eyeball is itching beneath my eyebarts, and I did not like that. It was very, very precarious situation.
I need you to get it together.
Because I almost stabbed myself in the eyeball.
I'm sitting here admiring your nails.
Oh, thank you.
Like, oh, those are fun.
Right? I'm just ignoring the horrors, because I don't want to, but I gotta.
Yeah.
So, weird hang-up phone calls, cleared as a suspect. Great. Except... not really, because they were still nowhere and had no idea what was there. Well, they're literally the only suspect we had.
Right.
And now what? Well, Her family went to Chico to do their own search for her, as they firmly believed that she wouldn't have just run away without contacting them. She'd never had a history of doing anything like this before, so it was deeply concerning to them. Mm-hmm. It's just unfortunate. So as time went on, the family hired private investigators, and allegedly, they even hired a psychic and a quote-unquote witch doctor.
Ooh, a witch doctor.
I wish I could have found more information on that, but I did not.
Witch doctor.
But they hired all of these people to...
Interessante.
...to find her. But despite police, the FBI, John Baruth, and the Sponeckys efforts, there was no trace of Marliz.
Man.
Her bank account remained untouched. All of her items stayed exactly where they were. And unfortunately, by 1977, her case had gone cold. To everyone involved, it was as if she had literally vanished off the face of the earth. Which now brings us to the question, and the horrors, what happened to Marliz Sponecky?
Well, I think we partially know, based on the dreams.
Well, I really need you all to imagine me as Willy Wonka right now, screaming at you in the middle of that hideous tunnel of torment. Because, yeah... the dangers must be growing. And I need you to understand that this is where shit is about to get so bad. Like, so bad. And once it starts, it's not gonna stop for a while.
Jesus.
For the rowers keep on rowing, and they're certainly not showing any signs that they are slowing. It's bad.
All right.
Acknowledged, also solid.
Yeah, thank you, and you're welcome. Yeah. Enough of that to the horrors. If you'll remember, I mentioned last week that Janice Hooker confessed to the police in 1984 that her husband Cameron had kidnapped Marliz Sponecky.
Yes.
This is the only account we have about what happened to her after she disappeared. So do with that information what you will.
One source and one source alone.
Yep. Some things might be a little unclear for a bit, but stick with me because I was again trying to figure out the most cohesive way to write this, and it might be a little bit confusing, but as always, I will get there. Now, according to Janice, on January 31st, 1976, she and Cameron, who lived about 40 minutes away from Chico in Red Bluff, had been out in Chico for a shopping trip when they spotted a young woman walking down Mangrove Avenue. Cameron pulled their blue Dodge Colt over and asked her if she needed a ride, which she accepted.
Yeah.
It was the 70s.
I know.
When she got into the back seat of the car, Cameron started asking fairly innocent-seeming questions like, what's your name, where are you from, where are you going, which Marliz readily answered. Unfortunately, his questioning was far more sinister than she'd realized, as she had let him know that she was fairly new to the area. She didn't really have any friends or family around, either. She also let it slip that her boyfriend currently had no idea where she was or when she'd be returning. Yeah. It's just... And she'd had no idea. She had no idea.
No! And it's 1978, why would you?
Well, 1976.
Six.
But yes. She then gave Cameron her address, and they headed towards her apartment. Mm. When they got there, Janice got out of the car to let Marliz out, because it was a two-door. Mm-hmm. But Cameron had other ideas. As she started to exit the vehicle, he grabbed Marliz by her long brown hair, yanked her back into the car, and shoved her head in between the two front seats. After threatening her with a knife, Janice got back into the passenger seat. He threatened Marliz with a knife. So she got back into the passenger seat, and they took off. Eventually, he stopped the car somewhere along a dirt road, where he proceeded to restrain Marliz by handcuffing her, and then putting that previously mentioned torture helmet over her head. It's a wooden box that weighed 20 pounds and was full of styrofoam on the inside, which rendered it soundproof.
Oof.
It also went completely over her head, so she couldn't see or hear anything. This horrific device was dreamt up and created and built by Cameron Hooker himself. So that's the kind of guy we're dealing with, and I cannot stress it enough, but it's about to get so much worse because he is truly a fucking monster. So if you look up pictures of the box, mm-hmm. it is absolutely jigsaw in real life. Like, it's fucked.
What's his name?
I'll send you one in a minute.
Okay.
So the couple, after they pulled off the dirt road to put this fucking torture helmet on her, they drove back towards their home in Red Bluff, but not before stopping at the local Jolly Cone for some cheeseburgers. Yeah. So from what I've gathered in my research, it seems like the couple stopped at the restaurant for dinner as a way to kill time before they went home, because they were waiting for the sun to set so their neighbors wouldn't see them bring Marliz into the house. Yeah. By the time they'd finished their dinner, it was dark enough to not raise any suspicions, and they went home. Cameron pulled the car into the garage and made sure to shut the door before prying eyes could see what's going on. He let Marliz out and removed the head box before he stepped away and left her alone with Janice for a brief moment. And there are some discrepancies in stories. Some say that she still had the head box on, and then Janice went inside, and when she came back out, it was off. But either way, this just tiny details that, in the end, don't really make too much of a difference. But Janice would share that she tried to calm Marliz down because she was very disoriented and hysterical, which fucking obviously, yeah. But even though she tried to calm her down by telling her everything would be okay, it didn't help because it wouldn't. And again, this is where the timeline gets a little fucky, but it seems like Janice went into the house for a minute. And when she went back into the garage, she could smell something weird, very chemically. And she asked Cameron what he'd done, and he told her that he'd sprayed starting fluid onto a rag and held it over Marliz's face to get her to pass out.
Starting fluid?
Like starter fluid for engines and stuff. Yeah. Very flammable.
Yeah. Most of those things are.
Yeah.
Or was it starter fluid for like a grit, like charcoal?
No. Okay. It was for, they didn't specify, but it was not for, it was for like some kind, like a lawnmower or a car or something like
that.
So that's fun. He carried her into the house and took her down into the basement. And if we've learned anything from this show, it's that nothing good ever happens in a basement.
Ever!
And it's not any different today. Because once they were down there, Cameron undressed Marliz and suspended her from the ceiling by her wrists. He'd already placed hooks in the rafters for this specific purpose. She began screaming and begging for him to let her go, and told him that if he did, she'd never tell anybody what he'd done. And while Cameron was super into what he considered BDSM, which it really wasn't, he actually just liked tying people up and torturing them, but more on that later. He wasn't particularly fond of screaming. So he decided to do something about it. He'd allegedly read somewhere that you could cut someone's vocal cords, and with zero further research, decided to give it a try on Marliz.
So it was just, you can do this. Cool. I'm gonna try it.
Yep.
Without knowing.
Yep.
Cool.
Uh-huh. Yep.
That seems ill-advised.
To put it lightly.
Yeah.
So he went upstairs and told Janice he needed her help, which she initially refused, but after he threatened to do the same thing to her, she changed her mind. They took Marliz into the bathroom, and Janice held her as Cameron cut one side of the young woman's throat with a knife. Shockingly, it did not go according to Cameron's not-at-all-well-thought-out plan, and when Marliz started to bleed profusely, Janice said that he freaked out and stopped what he was doing immediately, telling his wife that, quote, it didn't work.
Yeah.
You don't fucking say. Yeah. Mm-hmm. She held a towel to Marliz's injury while Cameron tried to think of his next steps. He then took Marliz back down to the basement, where she was again suspended by her wrists from the rafters. Still completely nude. He then sexually abused her. At one point, he came back upstairs and asked Janice to bring him some paper and a pencil, because Marliz wanted to tell him something, but she was unable to speak. After a little while, he came back upstairs and handed the note to his wife, which, according to her, read something along the lines of, I'll give you anything you want if you let me go. Marliz had also previously begged to call her boyfriend, telling Cameron that John could get money for him if he just let her go. She's like, let me go. My boyfriend will bring you money. Just let me go. Didn't happen.
Oh, it's not my way.
Instead of agreeing to that offer, Cameron refused and shot Marliz in the pelvis and abdomen with a pellet gun at least twice.
What the fuck?
Which, according to Janice, this was a torture thing that her husband apparently liked to do.
So she was familiar.
Yes. Which, more on that later.
Good.
Yeah. Around 2 a.m., Cameron came back upstairs. Only this time, Janice said he was distraught and asked her, what did I do? Which is...
Jesus Christ.
Bone-chilling. Because that was actually my first sentence as a child. What'd you do? What'd I do? But it always meant, what did I do? Because I would do something naughty and then take my mom and show her as I'm saying, what'd you do? And she's like, oh, Christ, I don't know. What did you do? Like, you know, coloring on something. I wasn't supposed to be pooping in the backyard. Who knows?
Yeah.
But this, far more sinister and awful.
And I want to clarify real quick for people who think I'm being insensitive. This is just how I deal with things that are insanely fucked up.
Oh, yeah. I don't think you're being insensitive. No.
The slight laughs and whatnot are just like...
It's just because it's fucking
crazy.
Uncomfortable.
It's, what the fuck?
It's uncomfortable, and it's like so crazy to me to think that someone can think this way that it's damn near humorous.
Exactly. Yeah. You're just like, what in the actual fuck? So, as it turned out, he had strangled Marliz to death. He requested Janice's help with disposing of her body, and when she went into the basement to do just that, she saw Marliz's naked body hanging from the rafters with a noose around her neck and a pillowcase over her head.
Okay, there it is. I was like, wait, we didn't get there. Okay.
Yep. The couple then proceeded to take her body down, wrap it in a blanket before they carried it out to the car. They then got into the car and started driving towards Reading, eventually hitting Highway 44 towards Lassen Park. It was dark and snowing outside. Eventually, Cameron pulled off onto a side road, which was nothing but mud thanks to the weather. They got out of the car, grabbed the shovel that he'd brought along, and he dug a hole about 3 feet deep. Cameron and Janice then put the body into the shallow grave, covered her up, and returned home. From the time Marliz was kidnapped to the time the hookers drove home after burying her in the middle of nowhere was roughly 12 hours.
Oh.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's not a lot.
Nope.
I mean, it's a lot, but it's not a lot.
Yeah. At some point after this, Janice said that they took all of Marliz's belongings to Dog Island Park, which wasn't far from their home, and burned everything. Everything except for her white gold Omega watch. Cameron kept that and wore it frequently, if not daily.
Jesus, tap dancing Christ.
In the book, Perfect Victim, they write that a coworker of Cameron's from Diamond International Lumber remembered seeing him wearing a woman's watch and asked him if he lost his watch and was wearing his wife's in the meantime, to which he said that yes, he was.
How are both of the killers for each of y'all so goddamn fucking stupid?
Right.
They're so dumb.
Well, unfortunately, dumb with just a little bit of luck, because Marliz's watch would later end up on a conveyor belt at Cameron's work somehow, like it slipped off or something.
Yeah.
Where it was promptly crushed by some kind of equipment.
God damn.
So the only physical evidence that they had was destroyed. Unintentionally destroyed. Whereas the rest of it, intentionally. And if any of what happened to Marliz sounds familiar, it's probably because I kind of touched on it when I talked about Jody's horrible nightmares last week. And if you'll recall, those dreams started up, they started up again about a year after she'd moved out of apartment 14. And the dreams also featured the random number 35.76. And occasionally she'd see A and 17.
Right.
In July of 2008, Jody decided to reach out to the Chico Police Department to let them know about her dreams, including what she thought they may have, or including that she thought they may have been coordinates to where Marliz was buried somehow. This call ended up putting her in touch with Sergeant Rob Merrifield, who says, or who she says, quote, listened to my story and referred me to the Red Bluff Police Department. But he told me, stranger things have happened.
End fact.
Quote. And he also was like, I am a skeptic, but who knows? She also spoke with investigator Kevin Hale of the Tehama County District Attorney's Office, who asked her why she called on that specific day. Initially, she wasn't actually quite sure what had compelled her to call when she did, but what investigator Hale shared with her next may have been the reason, even if she didn't consciously know it. Because apparently, they had decided that day to reopen Marla Sponicky's case.
Whoa.
And were in the middle of doing exactly that when Jody called.
Wow.
Which was something he would later say freaked him out.
What a dink of coinky.
Dink of coinky indeed.
Well, this whole thing is just so wild with the dreams and the haunting.
Very much so. Jody and investigator Hale would eventually meet up to discuss her dreams, but he wasn't at liberty to reveal much information to her as it was now an active and ongoing case again. Hale would later interview Janice to get some more information on where they'd taken Marliza's body in the hopes of recovering it, and she provided what information she could. In August of 2021, Jody and Hale reconnected, only this time he was able to tell her a bit more about the investigation that had occurred between their first meeting and 2021. The area where Marliza's body was believed to be buried is huge. So it's Lassen Volcanic Park.
Big area.
Yeah. Which, of course, is a huge problem when you're trying to find a body that was buried there 40 plus years ago. Yeah. However, according to Hale, there is a road that connects Highway 44 and I-5, that is A-17. As for the other set of numbers, Jody had assumed that 35.76 represented how far from Cameron and Janice's home the burial site was.
I think I might know what it is. Keep going.
Hale then informed her that they'd used mapping software to try and pinpoint the area where Marliz may have been buried. Their results in the mapping software? 35.77 miles.
Mm.
Off by...
a mile.
Less than.
Yeah.
Which, that's fucking weird.
Yeah. I thought it would be a mile marker.
Right. No, they assumed that was the distance from the burial, or the house to the burial site.
Yeah. Wow.
Jody's story was featured in an episode of Unsolved Mysteries in November of 2022. She said that they had approached her before the pandemic, but at the time, quote, I didn't really want to bring up any scary thoughts or haunting or anything like that. I was doing other things in my life, you know?
Like dealing with the pandemic.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they came to her right before the pandemic.
Oh, okay, got it.
But obviously she changed her mind and went ahead with the interview. But it wasn't her first, as it turns out. She'd actually told the story of Apartment 14 a decade earlier on the show Paranormal Witness.
Mm.
She'd also written a book about the incident in 2014 called Forgotten Burial, A Cry for Justice from Beyond the Grave. Following the Unsolved Mysteries episode, folks online started to become a little skeptical of Jody's story. Some point out that there are discrepancies between her accounts, both her book and both TV shows. While others wonder why it took her 7 years after she moved out of the apartment to reach out to the police about her so-called prophetic dreams. Others wonder why no other former residents of Apartment 14 have come forward to corroborate her claims. Though according to her, quote, I've had at least 10 people that have contacted me that lived over in that complex that had haunted experiences, end quote. And that, quote, I know she's tried to contact other people over the years in that apartment complex, maybe because I'm a sensitive psychic. I was able to experience more of the hauntings than others. I was able to have the sensitivity and eventually logically put it together, end quote. When she's talking about Marliz. It's been theorized by various online communities that Jody came up with the tale after reading Perfect Victim by Christine McGuire and Carla Norton, and later learning that she'd lived in the same apartment as the missing Marliz. There was also the time in 2008, which would have been around the time she contacted the police department, where her daughter Hannah filmed an episode for Psychic Kids, which never ended up airing. In spite of all that, Jody claims that her story is legit and that she shared her experiences for Marliz, her experiences with Marliz, saying, that's what it's all about for me. bringing resolution to this girl's family and letting her lay to rest and bringing awareness to the story. Mm-hmm. And as much as I truly hate doing this to everyone, but most especially myself, I am going to leave it here for today, because we're still not done. No, no. I've got much more on Cameron and Janice Hooker, Marliz, and Cameron's other victim, Colleen Stan.
Oh, boy.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Oh, boy.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
You say that like that's a name which, no.
No.
Okay.
No. Okay. Just the victim in Danielle's story was also named Colleen.
Colleen.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because we apparently do this.
Right.
Yeah. It happens.
We do this
all
a lot.
The time. But yeah, that's that.
So, question then.
Yes.
So, has her body been found?
I am not telling you.
Oh,
either way.
Okay. Well, that's what I'm saying. So the people who are tearing it apart, it's like, okay, well, I mean, if she's giving the police information that they didn't have before.
Well, they have searched that area and have not found anything, at least in that
right.
time frame. They hadn't found anything, but also it's because that place is fucking huge.
But again, I mean, how would she know the A-17?
Yeah, which is weird. There are little things where I'm like, I don't know. But there's other things where I'm like, I don't know, you might be full of shit. I can't tell. Yeah. Some of it maybe is complete bullshit. Some of it, I don't know. But, yeah, and I'll talk about it a little bit more. But when Janice was helping to try and locate them, it's been over 40 years now.
Yeah.
At the time. And I mean, she did, I believe, help them try and find, like, around the time she confessed that her husband had done horrific things. But
well,
she
I'm
was like,
assuming we're not mentioning him at all. He must be dead.
No.
Oh.
He is very much alive.
Oh.
He's just not saying shit.
Nope.
Interesting.
That's for next week.
That is
yeah.
for next week.
Yeah.
But
let's not bury the lead too
yeah.
much.
She was like, well, the scenery in the area is different because it was winter when they went out there. It was
right.
January 31st. It was the middle of the night. It was snowing.
You're not going to know shit.
And
you're not
between,
gonna recognize shit.
Right. And between 76 when that happened and 84 when she confessed, mm-hmm. like so many things could have changed. Like the landscape
Absolutely.
Could look completely different.
My mom's Airbnb was off Hawthorne and 36th. Do you know how much different that shit looks in the day versus
right?
night? I live
yeah.
here, and that was over the course of 4 days, let alone 10 years
right.
in a forest.
Right, like, exactly. So it's like, there could be so many slight differences. Like, there was a dirt road that they pulled off of that might not exist anymore. It could have been paved.
Uh-huh.
There's so many.
The snow by itself.
Exactly.
Right.
The snow itself.
That alone is
and
so much
in
of
the middle
mechanism.
Of the night.
Yeah.
It was white.
It
yeah.
was all white.
right?
It's like,
I mean,
you get there 10 years later, it's all brown. That's a huge difference.
Yeah.
Right. It's like, there, and not to mention, like, the trees.
Yeah.
Many trees could have grown in this area and, like, be covering where I thought we went. The trees could have grown in the on the dirt road that we
well, not only
drove
that,
down.
You get there, you see like 10 trees around you, and then black.
Yeah.
You go back during the
yeah.
day, you have no idea what was yeah. past those trees,
exactly.
if they're even still there.
Exactly. And it's like, when we were in Auburn, like, there obviously had to have been slip roads
mm-hmm.
that Gary Ridgway had used to get from his house into that area where he left the
yeah.
bodies of those women, but they don't exist anymore.
No,
they don't exist
because the plant is closed and it's
uh-huh.
all gated off now.
Yeah.
Exactly. So it's like,
so you can't even, but yeah,
stuff like that is just like,
and we think we found the entrance.
Yeah.
We drove by several times and we think like, we found like, where it was.
Yeah. At one point where it would mm-hmm. have been. But yeah, it's just the landscape could, even with just the season, like
yeah.
even going from winter into spring.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Could have completely changed everything. So it's.
No one's going to blame the lady for not knowing what's happening.
No,
there.
Exactly. So it's
we can blame
like,
her for lots of other things.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
not that.
Not recognizing
yeah.
where her body was buried 10 years prior in the middle
yeah.
of the night.
Yeah,
snowing.
And you might want to later, but...
Sure, sure.
But also, this is why I had to do it in three parts.
Yeah.
Because there is a lot, and it would, if I had done it all at one time, It would have just been me talking for hours.
And I imagine you also would have been half the person you are right now.
Yeah.
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 Because as rough and horrific as this was.
Oh, worse.
Yeah.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Because right. That was brutal.
Yeah.
That was pretty brutal. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I'll try to lighten the load.
Please. Yeah. Please do.
I'll do that.
Please. And you're going to be ending it next week, so that's great.
Yeah.
End on something even remotely lighter, because it's...
Yeah.
Let's get, like, a good alien story.
Oh, I'll work on that, yeah.
Yeah, because it's... Like that. It's not going to be good. It's really not gonna at all be good.
All right.
See, well, this...
Clearly not.
Hang on. I have this.
Monster Day. It's been monster... Yeah. Last 2 weeks.
Human Monster Day.
Yes.
This is... I'm not sure if this is the exact... same box that was used on Marliz, but this gives an idea. Yeah, like something out of fucking Saw.
Yeah, and it's like, if you don't know what that's for, it just looks like someone stuffed a bunch of boxes into each other and then cut out some space.
Like, what is happening?
That's rough.
Yeah.
Yeah. As you started telling the story today, I was like, oh, I do know this. But haunting aside, because that part was unfamiliar, because I've come across this case multiple times in rabbit holes in research, and I'm like, no, not today.
Yeah.
But
I haven't until now.
But I also had no idea. Like, I would sort of second rape, but I didn't go into like details. I just knew about the box.
Yeah.
Because I came across an article, The Girl in the Box, or something like that. So, and I was like, oh, that's what this is. Got it.
Yep.
So, yeah. All right. Well, I hope you're all okay.
Same.
Hope you're well. Today was rough.
Yeah.
I looked at the crime scene photos, so you all don't need to.
Yeah.
We will not be posting those. Obviously, they are inappropriate. I hope that the state of fucking Tennessee makes a decision real soon so that May can have her daughter's skull fragment back and so that she can finally put her daughter to rest.
Yes,
because
please.
That, I think, is some absolute fucking bullshit. So
it truly is.
Yeah. Well, we done it, y'all.
We did it.
You know the drill. Rate, review, subscribe. Share.
Uh-huh.
If you'd like some exclusive motherfucking content, go become a patron and our patron.
I think we got a new patron.
The last one was really funny.
I saw a new $5 notification on there.
Oh, I think that was somebody updating their card.
Oh, okay.
So, all right. Well, till next time, y'all.
Hexes and hoes, y'all.
Hexes and hoes, y'all.
Bye.
Bye. Mwah! Hats off to the fuck you club.
Yeah. Both of you. Both of them.
Fuck you, Krista Pike.
Yeah.
Fuck you. Fuck you. Fuck you. Fuck to Daryl Shipp.
Yep.
Shadola Peterson.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care that you turn state's evidence. It. All of you. Terrible, terrible, terrible. Horrible fucking human beings.
Mm-hmm.
Horrible. Mm-hmm. Horrible.
Sounds like fuck your horrible. Guy, too.
Oh, yeah. Cameron Hooker?
Yeah.
Fuck you, too.
Yeah.
And probably his wife?
Fuck her, too.
Yeah.
Janice Hooker?
Yeah. Because I already know. So, I mean, kind of.
Okay, well, preemptive kind of fuck you, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, fuck you.
Yeah.
It's like... Yes, and also
to all of you, eat shit and live, Bill.
You'll see.
Krista was horribly abused too. Still, fuck her.
It's fuck her.
Yeah,
it's not great.
No,
but yeah. So
anyway.
All right. Well, whatever. As your face flies, or some shit.
7 feet as the face flies.